Shrink Wrap Radio number 749. Blind Ambition author and motivational speaker, Chad Foster.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Chad Foster. Can you imagine going blind as a teenager? When most people were preparing for the adventure of adult life, Chad was watching the world he grew up with fade to black. But instead of feeling sorry for himself, he told himself, "I'm going to make blind look good." He became the first blind executive to graduate from the Harvard Business School Leadership Program and was hired by a Fortune 500 consulting firm. He wrote groundbreaking software that Oracle said was impossible, which created job opportunities for hundreds of millions of people. His book, Blind Ambition, is an eye-opening account of how he found his vision by losing his eyesight. Today's episode is brought to you by SymptomMedia.com. Now, here's the interview. Chad Foster, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me, David. I appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation.
Yeah, me too. I've been reading your remarkable book, Blind Ambition, How to Go from Victim to Visionary. And let me give a spoiler right off the start here. The main title, Blind Ambition, is a play on words that is in part a reference to the fact that you were diagnosed with a progressive eye disease as a toddler that would eventually turn into complete blindness. Mm-hmm. So I didn't put anything special in the title that would let my listeners know that, okay, my guest is going to be a blind person. But right. having got that out there, is there another meaning to the title, Blind Ambition?
Well, there is certainly, you know, how badly we want something in our lives in large part determines whether or not we're able to get it. I'm convinced that a big part of the reason I was able to overcome a lot of the obstacles that were put in front of me, whether it be in college, having to relearn how to learn, come to grips with my new dark reality and living a happier and more successful life, did come down to blind ambition. Certainly it's a play on words, but I also believe whether or not you want something badly enough determines just how much action and effort you're willing to pour into accomplishing whatever that outcome is.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you certainly were driven to overcome the obstacles that were in your way. Well, let's go back to the beginning for a bit. Give Sure. us a quick sketch of your family background and early years.
So growing up, I lived a mostly normal childhood. As you mentioned, early on as a toddler, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, and that's a genetic eye condition more commonly known as RP. And I was diagnosed when my parents noticed I had a hard time seeing in really dark areas. So I could see enough to play football and basketball and soccer, and I wrestled and rode a bike and played a lot of sports and was very active, but yeah. I did have problems in dark areas, whether uh-huh. it be at dusk or dark. And so they took me to Duke University at a young age, and I was diagnosed there with RP. And then growing up was a little bumpy. You know, you bump into things and figure out that you can't see certain things. The way that you realize you can't see something is when you bump into it. Ooh, and yeah. we do that, I think, figuratively in our lives. We find blind spots and things – that we weren't aware of by bumping into them figuratively, but I did that literally as well growing up. And we lived, you know, other than that, I'd say relatively normal middle-class family in Knoxville, Tennessee, and, you know, tried to live as normal of a life as possible. But when you're going blind, all of those, all of those ideas of normalcy start to fade a little bit.
Yeah. How did your parents cope with this? I mean, this must have been initially such heavy news for them to receive. And then as time went on, what was their, how did this impact their parenting style, if at all?
Well, yeah, it's hard for me to say at the time because they kept everything away from me. But you can only begin to imagine what it's like driving home on a 6 to 8 hour car ride, learning that the news, just hearing the news from doctors that your toddler will eventually go blind. Yeah. And so the doctors told them they should sign me up for a special school for the blind, but instead they signed me up for soccer. And I think that's a lot of their mentality towards my condition. It was, let's let him live as active as, you know, quote, normal, end quote, of a life as he can while he can. And I think in many ways they held me to higher standards because they knew that I would need to have a little more effort, a little more focus, and a little more determination in my life to make it through the obstacles that laid in front of me. And I think that was very thoughtful and forward thinking. I think the instinctive reaction, I know that my instinctive reaction would be with my kids as a parent myself, we want to protect our kids and we want to, you know, keep them out of harm's way. And I think that's the normal reaction, but they wanted to really push me too. And, you know, at the same time, they even, you know, built a basement in their house just in case I was not able to make it in the world. And I started to think of that basement as the loser basement, just in case life was too hard. I had a soft place to land, but I didn't really want to accept that.
You didn't want to be a loser. And I loved a little story that you told that maybe says a lot about your parents' attitude in raising you, was when your dad said to you, hey, why don't you go out and mow the lawn? And so you thought you thought you were going to get the lawnmower.
Yeah.
But instead
that
he
was
handed,
pretty old school.
Yeah, he handed you a pair of clippers and you had to crawl around on hands and knees to trim the lawn.
Yeah. He was pretty old school. He was the kind of guy, he did that. And we had all kinds of chores that we would do, whether it's restacking the big wood pile in the back of our yard or washing dishes and cleaning bathrooms. You know, every night we would be washing dishes and he would say, no, don't use the dishwasher. It's hard on the dishwasher. Wash them by hand. Okay, Dad, we'll wash them by hand. So he was a little old school in that regard, but obviously the amount of effort I had to put into doing the common things around the house was pretty helpful when I had that level of tolerance for effort. After I went blind and I had to relearn how to learn and then eventually learn how to write code to engineer my software without being able to see my computer screen just to do my job. Not many people have to engineer software just to do their job, but I was already used to working and putting in effort, so it wasn't that big of a deal for me.
Yeah. So they prepared you well. About how old were you when I assume at some point they let you know that you had a progressive eye disease that would ultimately lead to pretty much total blindness?
They did, although none of us really knew when or if the total blindness thing would really happen. And it was always in the back of my mind as sort of this intellectual concept. But you know, when you're a child, you're invincible. I was invincible like every other young boy who thinks they're invincible. But I think it really struck me how much danger I was in of losing my eyesight when I was 14 years old. And I remember we went to go see a top retinal specialist and he was blown away at how active I was. And he remarked that people who have my eye condition aren't that active. They don't do all the things that I do. And my mom was really touched by this. So she was, you know, in tears. She was very moved that, hey, maybe there's hope that he doesn't have what we thought he had, or this pending blindness won't ever really happen. And so that's the moment when it really struck me that it was far more serious than I ever anticipated. But at the same time, I felt like I was getting a get out of jail card. Hey, it's not me. That's, you know, I don't have that condition. You know, I've been given this free pass. And so that I was 14 years old at that time. And then obviously shortly thereafter, at about 18 or 19 is when it really began to fade.
Yeah. So skipping ahead, you end up at the University of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And so certainly that must have been a big transition with a lot of challenges.
Yeah, it was. Learning, I was going into the medical field initially. I wanted to go into the medical field. And as my eyesight began to fade, I realized it was really hard. I couldn't complete certain classes. For example, my anatomy and my physiology classes, I couldn't complete. And so I had to get a medical withdrawal from those classes and my major. And that was a pretty tough time for me because I had always seen myself as a hard charging young man ready to make a difference in the world, hoping to help other people in the medical field. And now I wasn't even sure if I could help myself.
Yeah.
So that was a difficult time.
Yeah. And also it was hard for you to give up driving. That was a very moving part for me because I'm going to have to give up driving before too much longer, I imagine. And, you know, that's such a big hurdle in our society. And you were out there driving even when you knew that you could hardly see. And finally, I think your friends kind of intervened, or actually you had a close call with hitting somebody and you decided, okay, that's it.
Well, I don't know that I almost hit somebody, but I certainly lost track of the road. The sun got in my eyes and it was really hard to see the road. And I was scared, really scared for 2 or 3 seconds. I just pulled over to the side of the road. It terrified me so much that I couldn't drive again after that. It was incredibly just terrifying when you literally can't see where you're going for 3 or 4 seconds because the sun was so bright in my eyes. And that was unusual because normally my condition was managing the darkness. So if I could see during the day, I at least knew where my boundaries were. But for the first time ever, it happened in broad daylight. The glare on the road, you know, the sun hitting my eyes, it made it too hard to see the road. And so that was a real telltale sign for me because before that it was always, hey, just don't drive at dark and everything is fine. But now it was in the middle of broad daylight.
Yeah. So aside from your own ambition and determination and character traits, there were two things that really made a difference in your ability both to complete school and to become the successful business person that you were able to become. And one was getting a guide dog, and maybe you could talk about that process to us. That, to me, that was, I love the way you kind of went into some detail. You know, we see the sighted of us, we see people with guide dogs, but really have no understanding of the whole process of bonding with the dog and so on. Take us through that.
It's a really remarkable thing to see what these dogs are capable of. I went there not knowing anything about it other than what people had told me about guide dogs being able to really change the game of mobility for people who are blind. So I go there and I arrive on campus at Leader Dogs for the Blind in Rochester Hills, Michigan. And I arrived with a mindset that wasn't too productive. I was still very bitter and angry from the fact that I'd gone blind. You know, we ask kids all the time, what do you want to be when you grow up? None of them say they want to be a blind person.
Right.
So that was a difficult time coming to grips with that. It wasn't what I had signed up for. Life happens to all of us at some point. And so how do we move through that process? And a lot of that happened to me when I was at Leader Dogs. And I went there to learn about how to use a guide dog, but I ended up learning a far more valuable lesson to me. Now, there were people there. Some of them had mental impairments and they were also blind. Some of them were on dialysis because they had diabetes that had robbed them of their eyesight. And some were deaf and blind, and they were getting a dog to be independent. Now, for these people, we had to talk with an interpreter who would sign into their hands, and that was the only way that they could communicate. Yet they were getting a guide dog to travel independently. Now, it's one thing when you meet someone on the street and you hear how rough they have it, but it's another thing altogether when you live with them firsthand and see their challenges for a month. And that's really what the process was, is living with them for a month as we got our guide dogs. It really etches it into your memory and forever changed my perspective on life. I learned that happiness is not a feeling and it's not an emotion. It's a decision that we choose to make every single day.
Definitely.
When we wake up.
Yes,
and so
definitely.
We can either let the circumstances of life affect our happiness, or we can choose to drive our own outlook on life. And I learned firsthand that everything, our perspective, is anchored to, number one, gratitude in our lives. And never was that more apparent to me than that. But the process of getting the dog is pretty, it's very interesting. They don't give you the dog immediately. They first teach you the nuts and bolts of dog psychology, what drives dog behavior, positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement. We learn about things like operant conditioning and how that can, using what's more commonly known as clicker training, can really drive positive outcomes with dogs. That was obviously founded by B.F. Skinner. I think it was in the 1950s and 60s where they were using that with pigeons. And obviously we see that with dolphin training, and that's being used more and more now today with dogs. But when we first get our dog, they don't really ask too much of us and the dog because the relationship is very fragile. So when we got our new dogs, I got Miles. Miles was phenomenal German Shepherd. It's this really delicate balancing act because they say the dog needs to respect you. So if you tell the dog to do something, the dog needs to follow through. But if you ask something and follow through and you're asking too much too soon, you can fracture the relationship permanently. So it's this very delicate balancing act of bonding and not asking too much. But when you do ask, making sure that the dog respects you. So you have to be super cool, easygoing, but at the same time, you have to mean business when it's time to mean business. And that's particularly true during those crucial transition periods. A, when you first get the dog, and then a month later, B, when you take the dog back to your house, because all of a sudden, everything that dog has known for the last 6 months, i.e. the training grounds, the handlers, all those things are gone, and you are the only connection that that dog has to its former life. So that transition period, that next, call it month to 3 months, once you get back with your dog, is crucial.
Yeah, what a huge step that is. I mean, here you are alone where you're living in an enclosed space with your dog who's never been there before. Yeah. and totally dependent on the dog. And you really bring that to life. I have to say, and I don't mean to demean the challenges that you've gone through, but you tell a really good tale in this book. The book is worth reading just as a story. It's so well told, and some of it comes across with such vividness. For example, before you even get the dog, one of the trainers is hanging onto the place where the dog would be and kind of leading you around so that you learn the feel of what it's going to be like when there's a dog on the other end. So just getting
Juno
all
training.
So all of those sort of nitty-gritty details were really, really interesting. And the whole and you talk about your dog Miles was a chick magnet. Maybe you can tell us about that. Because you're a young guy, you don't know if you're ever going to have a date or you're ever going to have a relationship with a woman. The dog turns out to be a blessing in more ways than one.
No one ever really wants to pet your cane. I'll say that. No one really asks to pet your cane. But when you roll into a singles bar with a 100-pound, 115-pound, beautiful German Shepherd that makes Lassie look average in terms of intelligence, it attracts people. And I think for 2 years, I probably didn't buy my own drinks when we would go out. My friends would get so angry with me. They're like, hey, give me Miles. I want to walk around with Miles. I want to borrow him. I said, look, he can bring them here. All you have to do is open your mouth. So we started, my friends wanted to rename Miles to Magnet. That was the ongoing joke. We need to change his name to Magnet because, but that was, look, there are not a lot of tremendous benefits of going blind. I'm going to shoot you straight. There are a couple, so you can bet you're going to take advantage of the few that there are.
Yeah. And I should mention, too, that you're a physically imposing guy as well. Not only was the dog physically imposing, but you're over 6 feet tall and powerfully built.
Yeah, we were pretty, and we walked really fast. So I've been working out since I was 14, and the dog's 100-pound, 115-pound German Shepherd, depending on, you know, when he finally matured. He should have been a guide dog for a sprinter. I tell you, he liked to go. And so between the two of us, when we come through, we're a load, right? We definitely, and I don't dress, I guess, like when you see me getting on a plane, I've had people mistake me for FBI or ATF. I'm usually wearing dark sunglasses, business suit, and German Shepherd. So yeah. When I go into a restaurant looking for a place to sit, I usually get seated pretty quickly because they're not sure if I'm there to eat or if I'm looking for bombs in the place.
Yeah, really.
They don't have to wait too long.
Really? Let me cut in here to tell you about today's sponsor, Symptom Media, films for mental health education and training. I know many of you are professionals seeking continuing education credits, and others of you are students or seekers of high-quality mental health training. Well, I'm happy to tell you, I've recently discovered the best source of CE units and therapy training out there. Their streaming library of video case studies designed to help students and professionals alike bolster their clinical knowledge. The quality is such that their traditional customers have been libraries and academic departments, but now they're making these resources available to individuals like you. What I find so unique about Symptom Media's CE courses is that you watch as instructors guide you through patient simulations, analyzing verbal and nonverbal cues, best practices, interventions, de-escalation techniques, and more. It's as if you're right there with the clinician seeing the patient. A subscription to Symptom Media gives you access to an enormous amount of training materials, over 600 video case studies, and over 20 CE courses, as well as new releases. These videos are used by countless healthcare professionals and over 400 universities, colleges, and medical schools. I urge you to explore symptommedia.com to see why these materials are so impactful. Now here's their special offer for my Shrink Wrap Radio audience. For 25% off any subscription, use the code SHRINK at checkout. Just go to symptommedia.com/shrink and then use the code SHRINK at checkout. Once again, that's symptommedia.com/shrink and use the code SHRINK at checkout. Now, back to the interview. Another good story was, as much fun as you were having with your chick magnet, you learned that, and we've all heard this, that we should not pet the dog of a blind person. We shouldn't get overly friendly with a guide dog. And yeah. you learned that big time, because you were enjoying all the attention and letting people sort of violate that rule. Yep. And then you were out one day and the dog starts pulling you in a direction that you know you're not supposed to go. And the dog's being really, this is early in your relationship with the dog, and the dog
That's right.
leading you across traffic and so on to go across a big street. And it turns out that the dog has caught the sight of a girl from one of the bars you'd been to across the street. And so he wanted to go say hi.
You know, he was trained well. He was trained well, but not really great at multitasking. He didn't factor in there was a bus coming to our left slammed on its brakes and blew the horn. And here I am trying to pull the dog back onto the curb. And it was pretty scary. Cars coming in either direction, but the bus was obviously the scariest part because I wasn't sure if it was going to be able to stop. And then that was it. Obviously, at that point, it kind of changed my outlook on just how much I could manage the dog's attention. So after that, I did put the sign on the harness that says, "Do not pet me, I'm working." much to the chagrin of my social life. My social life wasn't all that appreciative of it, but I can live to talk about it now, which is a good thing. But it was pretty scary, and dogs have priorities. But when it comes to getting attention, attention first. And that's why those rules are there, because dogs are not really great multitaskers, not like people are. People may think they are, but none of us are really great multitaskers. But certainly when dogs are guiding a blind person around, it's a very intensive task in terms of cognition. So we need to make sure that they have all of their attention focused on that. Otherwise, somebody could get really hurt.
Yeah. So there was a whole very important chapter in your life was getting the dog, learning dog psychology, bonding with the dog, et cetera. And, and so that was just a huge stepping stone. And one of the other challenges that you had is that you discovered that you had always been a visual learner. When you were sighted, you said you had almost like photographic memory. And so learning came easy that way. And then for that channel to suddenly be gone.
Yeah, that was a bummer. You know, things did come easily for me, which visually was great when I could see. Not so useful after you go blind.
Yeah.
When you have a great memory. But I ended up having to relearn how to learn, had to develop a new learning system. And it turns out I was actually a better blind student than sighted student. Because,
well, that's good.
Yeah, because I was forced to, instead of memorizing what was on the page, I was forced to sit down and actually consume information. Now, my mom read all of my business books to audio tape for me. We didn't have books on Kindle or audio or any of that. So my mom literally sat down and read every single business book to cassette for me. And my new learning system was I would read the book twice. I would record each lecture and listen to them twice in addition to the live lecture. And then I would go over the notes that the note taker from the university assigned me. I ended up making straight A's. I never made below an A in all of my college and business classes and made the dean's list for the first time. So I was a better blind student. Now, that doesn't mean that I was learning quicker, but I was certainly learning more deeply than I had before, because I was forced to pay more attention. I had to really pay attention to my focus and my effort and my determination. I was forced to, you know, to kind of, as we were saying earlier, single task as opposed to multitask. And that became my priority, was getting my education so that I could get a good job. Because when somebody like your mother sits down and reads every single business book to cassette, you can't let that person's effort go to waste. And so that was something that really resonated with me, was making sure all of that effort went to good use.
Yeah, yeah. And we just had Mother's Day, so.
Absolutely. The timing is fantastic. And the amount of patience and versatility that my mom had is just off the chart. That was just one of many things that she did. She was at our house. She was our caregiver. She was our plumber, our electrician, a carpenter. She was a bookkeeper. I'm not sure there wasn't anything that she couldn't do.
Wow.
In addition, she probably deserves a degree from the university. They did give her an honorary Accomplished Alumni Award when they presented me with that back in 2014, which was much deserved, obviously.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Now, another major stepping stone, much as learning to deal with the dog, was learning to deal with something called the JAWS system. An assistive system for the blind. Maybe you can bring us up to date on that. I knew there was technology like that out there, but didn't really know much about it. And how challenging it was to learn that system. And JAWS stands for, I forget, it's an acronym. What is that?
Job access with speech. This was built initially in the 90s. For Windows, and JAWS is JAWS for Windows, so it runs on the Windows platform. Nowadays, there are similar technologies on Mac and Linux and iPhone, iOS, Android. But essentially what it is, you can think of it as a way to convert text or textual representations of graphics into speech output. So it will read you what's on the screen. It is a screen reader, and it's a little complicated when you think about all the things that are embedded in an operating system or an application. It has to convert all of those things into a taxonomy that is consistent and reliable and able to be interacted with using a keyboard. Because when you're blind, you know, your hand-eye coordination is not that good. My hand-eye coordination is not great anymore, not going to lie. Yeah. So you have to use keyboard navigation for everything, and you have to learn a taxonomy of hundreds of controls, whether it's a list box, a multi-select list box, a checkbox, a radio button, an edit field, a multi-line edit field. I could go on and on and on. But all the different controls that are built into an operating system, the things that Windows uses to communicate information, it needs to do that verbally. Yeah. And it behaves a little bit differently in a native Windows application. Say, for example, Microsoft Word. It behaves differently in Microsoft Word than it does on the internet, because on the internet it has a different way to operate based on the metadata inside the program. And I could get really geeky and nerd out here. I'll avoid that. But okay. Suffice it to say, it gets a little nuanced in terms of how you interact with a web page versus a document versus a spreadsheet versus an email program. You have to learn how it interacts with all of those things. And you know, I ended up making it my hobby, and then eventually professionally I learned how to write code to engineer that software so that I could do my job more effectively.
Yeah, to me it's amazing, and I imagine that's partly why we can have this conversation now on Zoom, that somehow you are able to communicate with your computer to go to Zoom and get it all set up. So
I always tell people this is a good time to go blind.
Yeah, I was really moved by you make that point, because you went blind in a period where technological assistance was just starting to happen. And so in that sense, it was a good time to go blind. And I guess also maybe the guide dog, understanding of how to use guide dogs and making them available, maybe that was still just pretty fresh as well.
It's remarkable when you think about all the things that are coalescing between technology. And then, of course, you have smartphones that came out, you know, recently. We'll say, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, they really started to proliferate. The internet was lifting off. We're in a services-based economy. The fact that things aren't as physically intensive as they used to be because of the hand-eye coordination that I mentioned earlier, I probably wouldn't make the best factory worker. So just having the ability to sit at a computer and do things like, you know, research, something as simple that people might take for granted 30 years ago before the internet, you would have to go to the library and use the Dewey Decimal System.
Right.
How would I do that not being able to see? Now, I'm sure there were blind people who would get someone to help do that research, but now we just open Chrome and go to Google and you can find anything you want on the internet. So all those things that I think a lot of us now today take for granted, it's just, it's a game changer when you can't see, whether it's research or managing your finances or investing or reading or entertainment, everything's done electronically now. And so with that, it's opened up a world of possibilities.
Yeah. In fact, there's one paragraph that I pulled out that I'd like to read here.
Sure.
That says a lot of what you're saying. You write, some might say that blindness is a disability, and that's a fact, but that isn't the only fact about blindness, and it's far from the only story worth telling about blindness. If I want, I can choose to believe that there's a purpose to my blindness. I'm blind because I'm strong enough to deal with it. I'm blind for a reason, to help others see their own potential. I can go farther than that. I can tell a story that I'm grateful for the gift of blindness, for the perspective it's granted me, and for the challenges it's offered me, all of which have made me a better person. By reframing our deficits through these stories we tell ourselves, we can transform those deficits into our greatest assets. Choosing better stories about your weaknesses and frustrations can open the door to a self-fulfilling reality of strength, determination, and purpose. So that's in the context of you, of an area where you were talking about the importance of the story that you tell yourself. And this has led to, in part of your career is manifested as a motivational speaker. And so that's a big part of your message.
It's crucial. It's crucial for us to learn how to take control of the narrative in our minds so that we're not just letting things unfold however they may haphazardly unfold. We can choose what meaning we attach to events. We can control the narrators in our minds. We can will ourselves to a new image, a new vision of our own greatness. But we have to have an open mind to be able to do that. We have to have the conscious, focused attention of what stories we have playing in our minds, the stories that take us where we want to go. And that, in my opinion, is what resilience is all about. None of us control everything that happened to us. None of us. It's not right. possible to control every single thing that happens to each of us. But we can control how we respond. We can control the stories that we choose to tell ourselves about our situation, the stories we choose to tell ourselves about ourselves. How do we see ourselves? It's really important to take control of that intentionally, because we all will become those stories, whether we like it or not. And so we better make sure that whatever narrator we have in our mind, it's playing the right story.
Yeah, well, that's really well put. And of course, a couple of other chapters really stand out in this journey of yours. And one is, there was the bar scene, the dating scene, et cetera. But for a long time, that really wasn't coming together in terms of a real love relationship. And then you met this Brazilian girl who was very different. And so and she becomes your wife. So yep. Tell us a bit about Evie.
Well, it was interesting because a lot of times, as I mentioned, Miles had been the magnet, right? Miles was the chick magnet, and people would come up and he was an easy way to engage a conversation. And so that's usually what most people went to. They would come up and ask about the dog. It was sort of the layup, it was the layup, come up and talk about the dog and then talk to Chad.
And then move on.
Which was, it was entertaining and it was fun. And it served its, it was a great way to meet people. But it did kind of get old after a while. It never really led to any relationships that were deep and meaningful. And when she and I met in September 2001, she didn't say anything about the dog. In fact, I was really bizarre, David. I wasn't even sure. I thought maybe she has a vision problem, because she didn't say anything about this 115-pound German Shepherd laying at my feet. Yeah. We've been talking for an hour and she didn't say one thing about the dog. So I'm puzzled. Like, is she okay? Can she see really well? Yeah. But instead of, like most people, they meet somebody and they're focused on, all right, what does her hair look like or what kind of clothes is she wearing? I wasn't seeing any of that. I was just focused on the fact that she was energetic and she was articulate and bold and all of these things that I think I can see more deeply now because I'm not distracted by what my eyes are telling me, which I think a lot of people tend to get distracted by. And I did too when I could see, but I think now not being able to see makes it easier for me to see who people really are.
Yeah. Yeah. And so as your relationship deepened and at one point you decide to go to Brazil, where she was from, and she wanted to go see her family because she hadn't seen them in some years. Mm-hmm. And you decide to go to Brazil. And as you point out, Brazil had none of the social support that exists, none of the sort of assistive facilities for disabilities at all.
Yeah.
And yeah. Tell us about that in your own
words.
That
was a challenge. Yeah. Getting things that we take for granted here. I certainly take for granted here the civil liberties of being able to take your guide dog into a taxi or into a hotel or to a restaurant or all these things that are just thankfully now these are second nature. Now this is because of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which thankfully my dear friend and a gentleman who one of the endorsers of my book, Tony Coelho, he wrote the Americans with Disabilities Act, former congressman out of California. And now, thankfully, we can take those things for granted, so to speak. In Brazil, you can't. You could not. I could not get into many of the places that we wanted to go. My then girlfriend, now wife, had to spend a lot of time calling and convincing hotels to let us stay, calling and convincing restaurants to let us make an appointment. And it was really exhausting. Every taxi ride, you know, just getting out in the, getting on board a plane, everything was just, it was exhausting. So when we got back after 3 weeks in Brazil, I was certainly glad to be back in the United States. I enjoyed it. I had a great time. We had a phenomenal time, and I enjoyed the culture, and I enjoyed the food, and I enjoyed the time there. And I proposed to my wife, my girlfriend, while I was there. So it was a great, great time. But from the standpoint of using a guide dog in public, it was a lot more difficult than what we're used to here in the United States.
Yeah, that whole thing was fascinating. And as wonderful, that wonderful romantic story of meeting and all, and the initial glow of that relationship, like so many other relationships that human beings are in, you hit a rough patch where you guys separated and you weren't sure it was going to go on. Take us through a little bit of that.
Yeah, so we were living in Northern Virginia. We had just had our first child, our daughter, and it was some of those tensions came into play, you know, not being around family. We were living in Northern Virginia. Her family was in Atlanta. Being out there, not having that foundation, I think, certainly didn't help. Obviously, Latins are very close to family. I was working a lot. There was some tension and maybe a lack of communication. I was overworked and not really spending enough time around the house. And, you know, she decided that she wanted a break. She wanted to separate. And I had to take that humble pill of reexamining myself and making sure that I could prioritize what was important to me in my life. And the conclusion that I came to is, all right, I might be sacrificing my career by moving away from headquarters from the Washington, D.C. area back to Atlanta. That might be taking a step back in my career, but what can I live with? Can I live with prioritizing my career still yet? Or when I look at my daughter's face 30 years from now, what conversation do I want to have? Do I want to have the conversation of I did everything I could to make this possible, including rebalancing my priorities and making sure that I put everything into keeping the right balance in life and prioritizing my wife and my family, or would I want to have that other conversation? And I came to the conclusion that I couldn't risk not putting myself into that. So we moved back to Atlanta, started working on us, saw a counselor, eventually got reconciled, and now we have another child, Jackson.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So we've got a 4-year-old now who's running around the house, terrorizing everything. Little Chad Jr., as we like to think of him. He's like me, but thankfully both children have perfect eyesight. They don't have my eye condition, which I can, you know, that's autosomal recessive. So it would, the odds are very low that they would have had it, especially with Evie being from another part of the world. It diversifies the gene pool a little bit. So the odds of her being a carrier for that genetic mutation are quite low. But yeah, we moved back to Atlanta and things are better. I'm not going to say that they're perfect. I don't think anything is ever perfect. There's always something to work on, but it takes a bit of humility of reexamining yourself and making sure that, you know, you're showing up the way that you want to show up and you're putting people first who need to be put first.
Yeah, I really appreciate you acknowledging that things aren't perfect, because, you know, a lot of people who write books like this, who are motivational speakers and so on, may present that kind of an image of follow my 5-step formula and you will be happy forever and enjoy great wealth and so on. But life is life. And as you pointed out, we don't know what cards are going to be dealt as we go along. So Juliana was your daughter, is your daughter. How old is she now?
She's 12.
12. So you got a 12-year-old and a 4-year-old. And is Miles still with you?
No, Miles is not. And in fact, there's been Romeo since Miles and now Sarge. So Sarge is the current guide.
Okay. So I was wondering about that because, you know, we tend to live longer than dogs. And so that's got to be one of the challenges, because I'm sure it's hard when you lose that dog. I mean, such a strong bond that exists between the two of you. That's got to be a big challenge.
It's huge. It's like a family member.
Yeah.
You know, you're with them all the time. Not only are we together around the house, but every meeting I go to, every flight I take, every conference, you know, it's me and Sarge or me and Miles or me and Romeo 100% of the time. And so you do build up this really strong connection, and it's teamwork. The dogs, they're not robots. They work for you because of the bond, and it's the teamwork of me giving the dog. If you could think of it as mapping directions, I need to know that we need to go left and look for an elevator or an escalator or a set of stairs or a chair, or I have to know the big picture of what we're doing. The dog has to help me execute that big picture with point to point guidance. So the dog doesn't know, hey, Chad wants to go to gate B72, doesn't know what that means. But when I'm in the airport, I can say, all right, left escalator. We get up the escalator and I can say, all right, we're going to go right. And after about 300 or 400 yards, I'll say, all right, left gate. And so it very much is teamwork. We have to be in sync. And in order to make that happen, there has to be a bond. There has to be love for one another. There has to be some fun and some gamesmanship, because dogs, they love the puzzle. They love the intellectual challenge. It has to be fun and engaging. I think there's a lot to be said for using those same concepts in the professional workplace too, but it's deeper than just a pet. It's not like a pet. Pets aren't asked to do the things that these dogs are asked to do. And these dogs know that there's a lot on the line. They know that it's their responsibility. They get it that, okay, it's a game, but they also get that if I mess up this game, he can get hurt. Yeah. And that's something that you see weigh on them after a while. And so you have to factor that in and try and make it as lighthearted as possible, because the gravity of the job is evident. Yeah. And so you want to make it as enjoyable as possible, but certainly when the time comes, it's a painful time.
Yeah. Well, you managed to become a very successful executive and salesperson, I think, and in some major corporations. I'm wondering what's happened for you during this pandemic. You're talking about going to airports and so on and escalators and all of that. I assume that during this year of isolation for most of us, that you've not been doing that. So what's life, how have you gotten along during the pandemic, and what do you see for yourself as it begins to open up?
Well, I think my family now remember what I look like, which was good. They maybe had forgotten. It was a lot of travel before. I traveled 80-90% of the time because I ran global teams. I had team members all over the world and in lots of different countries. The first year I had Sarge, we probably went to 20 or 30 countries in the first year. So he's been around. And now with COVID, we could actually spend some time at home, which is great to be able to connect and you know, kind of make up for that time. You think about all the time that you spend in airports and hotels and conventions and things like that, getting some of that time back with family. I think it's important to find the silver linings in life. Obviously, that's a key point of my journey, finding the silver linings and going blind. And COVID, it's been a difficult year. There are some silver linings. It doesn't mean that we love everything that happened about COVID. Doesn't mean that I love everything that happened about going blind, but it does mean that if we look hard enough, we can find benefits in them. And one of the benefits for me in COVID was just being forced to stay at home and spend time with family and not be stuck in airports and hotels. But I do think that's opening back up. Hopefully now we're going to start to see people get back face to face, which I think we're missing. I'm certainly missing those face to face connections with people. I think our society could use a good dose of humanity. I think a lot of the division that we see, I think it just gets so much easier to have division among people when there's abstraction. And technology makes a lot of great things possible, like me and you to have this great conversation being hundreds of miles apart. But it also makes it easier to abstract the humanity out of it. I think you get that online a lot. People, they get behind their keyboard, and there are a few keyboard cowboys out there who like to drop, you know, comments on people without having to worry about the fact that there is a real human on the other side of the internet there. I think getting back in person with people will hopefully help make that a little harder, where you can't be as cruel or mean to someone who's right next to you. And maybe you'll have a little more empathy and a little more humanity when we're having those conversations, to try and understand where people are coming from, as opposed to just sending message to people across the ether.
Yeah. Yeah. And I certainly hope that that becomes true. There's so many challenges before us all. So I'm wondering if there are, I think in your person and in this conversation, your philosophy and message has really come through. But as we start to wind down here, I want to make sure that you get to say everything you want to say.
I appreciate that. Well, I think it fundamentally, you've got a couple of concepts. Just to reiterate, the stories we tell ourselves is probably the most important thing. You will become the story that you tell yourself. The second key point is none of us are responsible for all of our circumstances in our life. None of us are. But we have to own our life and its outcomes. It's my life. I have to own it. It's your life. You have to own it. If you don't own your life, who will? So I could sit here and I could make 1,000 legitimate reasons to not get to my goals, lots of legitimate reasons to fail. And how would they serve me? They really would not serve me. They might comfort me in the moment, but at the end of my life, and I look back on it, would they help me then, or would I have regrets? And so I really believe that we have to force ourselves, hold ourselves accountable for our life, even though we're not responsible for all of our circumstances, because if we don't get what we want out of our lives, the only one who loses will be us. And so I would encourage everybody to just think about that and how they can hold themselves accountable to get what they want out of life, because we've only got one shot at it. And you know, who knows how long we have to make our dreams come true.
Well, Chad, I've really appreciated this opportunity to meet you and chat with you a bit. And I want to thank you for a most inspiring interview and a very well-written book, which I'm happy to recommend and promote to my audience. And so thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me, David. I appreciate it.
I'm feeling very privileged to have had the opportunity to meet and get to know Chad E. Foster, today's guest. His book, Blind Ambition: How to Go from Victim to Visionary, is especially good on many levels. First of all, it's a good tale, well told. Beyond this, it's such an inspiring example for all of us who have the privilege of being sighted. If he can find the silver lining and maintain positivity in the face of such an extreme life challenge as blindness, surely we too can take heart from his example. Beyond this, most of us probably don't have a blind friend willing to share as openly as Chad does in this book. Just as Chad learned empathy when going through the Guide Dogs for the Blind program, surrounded by other students saddled not only with blindness but other disabilities as well, so can we learn empathy from exposure to his story. I know I did. Chad learned so many important life lessons as a result of his challenging journey combined with his own personal gifts. He learned that he could choose happiness instead of depression and defeat. He learned the rock-bottom importance of the story we tell ourselves. In this regard, I quoted the following passage from his book in the interview, and I quote, "Some might say that blindness is a disability, and that's a fact. But that isn't the only fact about blindness, and it's far from the only story worth telling about blindness. If I want, I can choose to believe there's a purpose to my blindness. I'm blind because I'm strong enough to deal with it. I'm blind for a reason, to help others see their own potential. I can go further than that. I can tell a story that I'm grateful for the gift of blindness, for the perspective it's granted me, and for the challenges it's offered me, all of which have made me a better person. By reframing our deficits through the stories we tell ourselves, we can transform those deficits into our greatest assets. Choosing better stories about your weaknesses and frustrations can open the door to a self-fulfilling reality of strength, determination, and purpose." Close quote. His book challenges us, just as he challenged himself, with assertions such as, "Excuses are for losers," and "Dare to be great," and his determination to make blindness look good by always dressing sharp when going out into the world. These qualities, along with his courage to continually move out of his comfort zone, brought him considerable success in the business world and has provided him with an extremely credible base for being a motivational speaker and trainer. If you've been feeling a bit hangdog and needing a shot in the arm, I urge you to read his book, Blind Ambition, How to Go from Victim to Visionary, by Chad E. Foster.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Diane Cronmiller from Nanaimo, Canada. I wanted to extend my sincere thanks for all the time and hard work you've poured into this important and enlightening podcast over the years. I understand it's not particularly lucrative, which makes your dedication and consistency particularly admirable. I'm celebrating my recent graduation from Athabasca University's Master of Counseling program, and it felt important that a message and donation to you be included in my closing ritual. Though we've never met, I feel a kinship with you. You've been a constant companion through a most challenging 3.3 years of online study. As someone who's not a natural academic and struggles with sedentary screen time, the opportunity your podcast gave me to learn about psychotherapy while taking long walks in nature kept me inspired throughout my studies. For most of my degree, I was living on Salt Spring, a wonderful island full of hippies, farmers, and vacationers. I often felt isolated in my academic endeavor. However, as soon as I flipped on your podcast, I had the sense of being among colleagues, learning from the best professors in the field. There were many times I felt compelled to donate, but put it off with excuses of being a poor student. Let's face it, I will likely be in student debt for a long time, and yet I still manage to spend money on things of much less value than your podcast. With this realization, I decided to contribute a humble $5 a month in support and appreciation. Thank you for all you have done towards my edification and that of the psychological community at large. With deep gratitude, Diane.
Thank you, Diane Cronmiller, on a beautiful Canadian island, for your ongoing donations. I'm glad to have been helpful during the challenging years of your graduate study. Even though we've never met, I consider you a friend as well. I want to thank listener and former guest Paul Krause for his donation as well. And a big thank you to Cynthia Moore at Core Counseling, who has just become a regular donor and whose name will appear on the Honor Roll site. Thanks also to Chris Marvel, who is truly a marvel, and their name will appear on the Honor Roll as well. Again, I want to thank all of our regular donors out there. Your names are on the Honor Roll on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. This morning, I've been going through and updating donors from 2020 to 2021. Not only do I get to review the names of you faithful supporters of this work, but also to experience fresh gratitude for your continuing support in this new year. A big thank you to all of you folks. Thanks so much to today's guest, Chad Foster, author of the inspiring book, Blind Ambition, for an equally inspiring interview. My guest next week will be neuroscientist Dr. Kausik Sai, discussing his groundbreaking research on how the brain creates and stabilizes memories with important implications for the treatment of Alzheimer's. I hope you'll join us for this important conversation. So until next time, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.